The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone. Today we're going to be talking about cults with Dr. Stephen Kent. And Dr. Kent received his master's and his PhD, actually, in religion and modern Western society. Is that correct?
I think so.
Okay.
It's been a long time.
At McMaster University. This lovely gentleman has published a myriad of research papers on a number of different cults and different aspects of them. And he has a Wikipedia page. He currently teaches undergraduate and graduate courses that explore religion and deviance here at the U of A. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. And we are extremely happy to have him with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with the basics for lay people. What kind of characteristics would really define a group as a cult?
It's a controversial question, really, because many people feel that the term cult is pejorative, that it demeans people's beliefs and actions. What seems to be the case, however, is that people who use the term cults mean it to be that the belief system is unorthodox and somehow spurious. It's harmful. It's manipulative. It deceives people and so on. It's possible, for example, to have some orthodox groups that do harmful activities. And it's also possible for some groups that are unorthodox not to be harmful at all. So there's a whole range. A lot of my colleagues say they avoid the word cult, although even those people often publish books with cult in the title because people know what it is. You know,
right.
It's catchy.
Right. Okay. So what do you use instead of the word cults?
Sometimes I use the word cult. Sometimes I just avoid it and call these groups. What I tend to focus on, however, are groups that are outside the mainstream, groups that probably don't have a lot of their own members doing objective histories or analyses of what goes on in those groups. So the groups range. I've studied groups in the 17th century. I studied one in the 2nd century, a lot of contemporary groups. And what's always interesting is the unusual behaviors that go on in the name of religion, in the name of devotion.
What kind of unusual behaviors?
Because people attribute, and a lot of social scientists would say misattribute, divinity to leadership, people in the context of giving devotion to their leaders will do and have done extraordinary things. I mean, we think about the mass murder suicides and suicides that have gone on in recent years, some of the kinds of almost blind obedience that goes on to leaders throughout history, really. One of the interesting aspects of studying these groups is that one gets thrown back into history. The activities that I've seen in some contemporary groups, I've also noticed in groups from hundreds of years, in a couple cases, thousands of years ago.
Interesting. Okay. I guess one of the things that when I was mentioning to people that I was doing a show on cults, one of the questions that they had was, you know, things like Scientology and Satanism and Mormon fundamentalism. These fall into the cult, whatever word you'd like to choose, but the cult category. But how is this different than... Okay, what I'm trying to say is, if people join a cult, people want to do interventions. If somebody joins the Baptist church and goes to church every Sunday, people don't do interventions. So what makes one group more socially acceptable than the other group?
It is true that especially in the 70s and 80s, when people joined some of these high-demand groups, parents frequently would hire people at the time called deprogrammers. And sometimes those deprogrammers would actually use force to try to get people out. So there are incredible stories about kidnappings, holding people. And the reactions, by the way, of the people who were, quote, kidnapped, deprogrammed was quite varied. Some people are extremely thankful that parents and friends did the activities. Other people were terribly bitter about what happened. So it's a wide range. And probably the indications about what would motivate someone to try to get a loved one out of one of these groups has to do with the person's perception about harm or potential harm that the group is doing.
Okay.
So many of these groups, for example, require that individuals cut off contact with family and friends. Now, realistically, some family and friends probably worth cutting yourselves off from. And it's not
right.
Not all family and friends are nice, but in so many cases, these groups place demands upon people to renounce their former lives and turn themselves over completely to the guru, to the swami, to the teacher, to the new belief system, and so on. People change their names. People turn over all their belongings and so on. So it's those kinds of extreme activities that often would motivate parents to say, what happened to my kid? You know, I've known this person for 19 or 20 years, and then within a few weeks or a couple of months, it's a complete personality transformation.
That's just, you mentioned deprogramming, and one of the articles I believe you co-wrote on deprogramming and how it isn't really the same as it used to be. Did you want to explain that?
Sure. Deprogramming in the early days, when it first appeared in the 70s and through the 80s, often but not always involved various kinds of force. And force could be in the context of grabbing a person or confining a person or pushing ideas on a person that he or she didn't want to know about. A number of the deprogrammings, now, those people called deprogrammers, if they had the option, would not use force in those days. And there were many deprogrammings that were in various degrees voluntary. So there's a whole range from involuntary and violent to voluntary activities. Because, however, a number of deprogrammers who used aggressive techniques got in legal trouble. There were lawsuits and so on. A couple of deprogrammers got convicted.
From family or from the individuals?
What often would happen is that the deprogramming would fail in the context of what the parents wanted. And the person, the target, would go back to the group and often with the group's assistance, would sue the parents. There were also a couple times when the state initiated kidnapping charges against deprogrammers. So it's a risky business. I know of one guy who had someone take a pot shot at him. I mean,
really?
It was dangerous. It was very dangerous. And consequently, as often happens in social movements, people started to professionalize. So as more and more social workers and people with various kinds of counseling training got involved in the cult information, or if some people call it the anti-cult movement, they started to realize that for professional reasons, we can't do these kind of violent, we have to prohibit them. And they developed a series of professional intervention strategies that required permission of the person, so that the current they now call themselves exit counselors. The exit counselors will not do an involuntary deprogramming any longer. There has to be some consent on the part of the person to stay in the room and converse and hear the information.
Well, I can understand that, you know, in a certain way, but if somebody has been, you know, isolated and has been, you know, thoroughly brainwashed within that group, I have a feeling that they might not be that willing to stay in the room.
I know, and it's a complicated world. One can imagine scenarios, for example, that if a parent could have done an intervention with an adult who was in a high demand group like Heaven's Gate or Jonestown and didn't because of concerns about ethics or the law and so on, and then saw the consequences, you know, the murder suicides that happened afterwards, they would take their regrets to the grave. And so it was always a delicate issue with parents who believe that they were indeed assisting the person because they claimed the person could not think for him or herself, whereas the groups themselves said this is freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. These are adults, often young adults. They have the right to make decisions on their own. It's interesting, and in many ways tragic now. I've talked to quite a number of people who have been in high-demand groups 15, 20, 25 years. So the crucial aspects of life development, the 20s and 30s into their 40s, sometimes even older, have been devoted to a cause they eventually see as illegitimate, as spurious, and they've lost a tremendous part of their own life possibilities. So people are in their 40s and 50s and just going to university, never been married, never had children. Sometimes people will be in groups and are pressured to have abortions and so on. So they're high prices people pay very often for involvement in these groups.
I want to talk some more about this, but we have a call. Go ahead with your question, sir.
Well, I was kind of curious if Dr. Kent has seen any studies. I'm interested in prevention. Have there been any studies to sort of indicate what sort of behavioral trends or personality traits that would tend to have people get sucked into cults? And can we head that off, or, you know, can we avert them somehow?
It's a good question. And sometimes schools do have preventative education, but there are very few organizations now that are conducting, you know, cult inoculation, you may say. People often have predisposing factors that lead them to define their problems in religious as opposed to psychological or economic terms. In those contexts, if those people set out to be seekers, if they're out looking for answers in religious contexts, and they come in contact with a group, and that group enhances social interaction at the same time that that person diminishes or cuts off interaction with the outside world, then there's a pretty good chance the person is going to convert. Indeed, many conversions come through existing social networks, through family and friends. Consequently, we can help people see the patterns of cult conversion. I've also shown some videos to high school students about magicians. And these are people who, as you know, can do extraordinary things. And they are not supernatural, though they often appear to be. So we can help show people that individuals exist out in the world who are out to get their bodies, their minds, and their souls. But a lot of people are going to fall through the cracks. And even some of those people who have been you might say inoculated still may fall prey. I had one of my very good students a number of years ago turned out to have grown up in a high demand group, and even after she took my class, she got sucked in by the guru and had a couple of weeks of sheer confusion until she sorted things out. So it's a lot of people can fall prey.
Okay, so it's really not generally socially dependent people. There actually have been strong, independent thinking type individuals that have gotten lured into cults?
I know this. I've interviewed probably hundreds of people who've been in groups, and a great number of the people I've interviewed are far smarter than I am. It's just the case that I'm asking them the questions because for a number of complex reasons, they made often unfortunate choices about their lives. So it certainly isn't a matter of intelligence. A lot of people have come from very good families. Breeding skepticism is a good thing. Getting people to really ask questions and push is pretty good, too. One other context, I often talk to people about techniques that some groups use to recruit, which is to put people in circumstances for which they have no prior interpretive experience, and then give them an interpretation. Best example is some groups that use high-speed chanting or chanting in a foreign language and so on. If you can get a person to sit down with friends and do these kind of activities for 45 minutes or an hour, and they will have no idea what's going on and will want to give meaning to their lives, if a group and or friends come along and say, this is what you've done, you've been in contact with the ascended masters, the higher forces, then a number of people will buy it. And that's an entry point into the group. Other groups, look, everybody has personal issues, things in their past that they probably regret. Groups will use various techniques to get people to confess, to renounce their past, and in doing so, people have an enormous sense of relief, this tremendous unburdening. That's also another way people get into groups.
Did that answer your question, Tech?
Yes, it did, and you and Sean keep up the good work.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
And I believe we have another call on the line.
Yes, we do. I believe it's Nathan, who is the number two caller tonight.
Oh, Nathan is usually our first caller.
Yep. Tart beat me.
Go ahead, Nathan. What's your question?
Well, my question really revolves around how often do you find that mainstream religion or cults would become a mainstream? For example, when we take a look at like what happened with Jim Jones, we had this charismatic leader lead a bunch of people off to a faraway land, then kill a bunch of people who came through his area. Yet, for example, the Mormons did the same thing. Charismatic leader leading the congregation out to found their own colony, and they had their own little massacre, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. How often would a group like that become considered mainstream and a regular phenomenon?
It's a good question, Nathan. By and large, I should say by far, most of the groups that appear will die out. Some die out in a couple of generations. A few will carry on for a few hundred years. But for the most part, they don't make it. There's only a few religions that have gone on for generations, if not millennia. There are a couple of indicators about how a group can survive. One is that it has to have to be in some tension with mainstream society, but not in too much tension. A second technique that some groups use, and Mormonism is a classic example, is it says that its teaching is an extension of existing belief systems. So the Mormons will talk about the Book of Mormon as a further teaching of Jesus Christ. So moreover, if groups can win over the second generation, if these groups can keep children involved in the group, then these groups are on the way to possibly mainstreaming. It's also the case, too, that these groups have to appear in environments that are not extremely hostile to them. If a group were to appear, well, if you look at, say, Falun Gong in communist China now, it's under severe stress by the government. So there's a number of factors that help a group to continue.
Okay. Did that answer your question?
Yep.
Wonderful.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, sure. Goodbye.
Thank you. And again, we're here with Dr. Stephen Kent. We're talking about cults. So, Dr. Kent, you co-authored an article titled When Scholars Know Sin.
There's a story behind that title. That wasn't a title I chose. The editor, without my knowledge, chose it.
I found, interesting choice. What was your title?
Oh, I don't. It was some stuffy academic title. You see what happened? There's a story here, and it's an interesting story. I and a graduate student at the time wrote an article for an academic journal that was very critical of the way a number of scholars in this field were relating to and writing about these controversial groups. If you can imagine, these groups really want good publicity. Mm-hmm. Consequently, they often make themselves readily available to academics, and the academics who have access feel privileged. What the academics really don't take into account, however, is that these groups have done house cleaning before the guests arrive. So a number of studies have been really quite bad, and so we wrote an article for an academic journal, and we named individuals. Well, the editors got a hold of it, and they wrote back and said, oh, it's not convivial or congenial, collegial was the term, to name individuals. So they made us go through and strip all the names, all the individuals we named. And I said, this is nonsense. So we published the article, but I went to, I think it was Skeptic Magazine, and put in the names. So I put in the names, and then when it appeared, the editor had chosen this one, Scholars Know Sin, because the illustrator thought that he could do nice drawing sketches. And I
well,
just threw my hands up. So we got the message out, but it came at a cost of trying to say that my colleagues were sinful. And that's not my – I don't care if they are or not.
That was not the point of the article at all. So, well, can you give us a couple of examples from that article of different things that researchers have – I guess who have become less objective than they should be?
Oh, there are many examples. I did a couple of articles a few years ago about Scientology's what I called forced labor and reindoctrination program, the Rehabilitation Project Force, or RPF. Subsequently, Scientology gave access to several academics to an RPF program in England, and these academics wrote a report about it. Never got published in a book or a peer review journal, but appeared on the internet, saying essentially, "This is not a bad program. There's really no pressure. People get sleep, adequate food, don't work too much, and so on." Just a few days ago, I got a hold of a book written by a former Scientologist who said he was in England at the time that Scientology was preparing for the academics to come over, and he said the background preparation prior to their arrival was extraordinary. They went on for several weeks. They were fed well. They were rehearsed. They were told what to say and so on. So the group knew they were coming. And the same, the Children of God, another group I've studied, actually had set up what it called media homes. These were homes designed to receive reporters, academics, any outside interested parties. The Children of God had gone through their personnel and removed. I talked to one woman. I think she was 17 or 18. She was a single mother, had a young child, and she got booted because it didn't look good. They had gone through, and I've got the documents here. They had taken razor blades and cut out pages, controversial pages, of group publications, and they had a good curriculum. It was clean. They were well fed. Consequently, I know one academic went on television, and she said, "I went through," and she rolled her eyes and said, "Thousands of pages. I saw nothing about abuse." Well, of course she didn't. They had removed all this controversy. The group had book burnings. So when academics went to the media homes, they saw what the group wanted to present, and the people who had access to the documents prior to them being burned were saying, "You got duped."
And I find this interesting because after being shown that they have been duped, what do the academics, how do they react? Or do they refuse to believe that they have been?
Well, science is supposed to be detached research. We're supposed to objectively look at facts, and if the facts present something otherwise, we're supposed to change our minds. In reality, a lot of personal sense of self and self-worth gets tied up with research. Consequently, my own interpretation, what often happens is that I think a lot of my critical work on groups gets ignored. I see books that have come out on – there's a new book out on Scientology. There's a new, fairly new book out on Children of God. And the articles that bring out sensitive issues don't appear. Moreover, I often see people who may have been involved in some questionable earlier studies continuing to repeat the pattern. So if there's more out there and there's more out there that reinforces their position and ignores critical positions, then in the long run, in say 20 or 30 years, when people are looking up research, they're going to go to these books. So it's, you know, when I started off as an academic, I thought facts were facts and they'd speak for themselves. But there is an area called sociology of knowledge, and that area talks about how we identify what's a fact, how we think it's important, how it gets written up, transmitted, and accepted or rejected by the academic community and the wider world. And there's politics to it. What I find is a lot of reporters and people who've been in groups are often much more receptive to the critical material. There's a real gap between, for these high-demand groups at least, for former members and their statements versus many academic accounts about what life was in, what life was like to be in them. Indeed, there's a whole tradition in my field of categorically ignoring the accounts of former members. Don't even talk to them. It's not a matter of hearing what they say and testing to see if you can verify what individuals tell you. It's a categorical denial of former members. They're biased. They have agendas. Ignore them.
Interesting.
It's very strange.
So academics don't have agendas.
Oh, academics have tremendous agendas.
All right. Interesting. You were also actually even called upon quite a few times to give testimony in legal cases.
Most of those cases don't go to trial. A couple have. Groups or cases involving controversial groups have a lot to lose in many instances. These groups often don't want a legal precedent set against them. So very rarely do these actually go to a decision. So I've written a number of reports and expert testimonies, once or twice. Twice at least, maybe more, been deposed. Once or twice been on the witness stand, but almost none of those cases ever go to either jury or judge decision.
Because I know there were some high-profile ones, obviously, with the ritual abuse cases.
Yeah. All the ritual abuse cases. I got a lot of flack for my work in the area of people claimed to have been ritually satanically abused. I actually did testify. It's a case I did testify out in, I think, Stony Plain, in a case. Social services brought me in. And, you know, social services had really no agenda in this case. And it was a real tragic case in many ways. The mother was on her second round of kids, and I think she was such a bad mother, the first round of kids came back to testify against her for the second kids. But these kids had just amazing stories about what really sounded like satanic abuse by the boyfriends. So there wasn't the hard evidence, though. I got various levels of evidence, but not enough ever to go to lay conviction. So sometimes I get different people in the same family telling very similar stories. Now, you can argue possible contagion. In one instance, we had two people. There's another researcher in Calgary doing this study. He came up with a person who claimed to be in the same group as someone that I had spoken to, and these two people hadn't seen each other in 9 years. In another instance, a person gave me permission to get her medical photos from a hospital. So I went to a hospital and picked these up myself. And she had a burn, a cross burned on her cervix. And she said the group leader did that to her because she'd thrown up on him. How do you prove that? So it's levels of suggestive evidence. But my first case actually involved someone whom later I found had a long history with the police of suspicions about satanic abuse, but there was really, you couldn't prove it. It is the case that some of the accounts were not proved. In one case, someone said in that corner, 4 feet over, 5 feet over, 5 feet down, there's a buried pickled fetus. Okay, fine. We dug, it wasn't there. Another instance, I did an interview with RCMP, a woman who was in a safe house down here. And after we talked to her for about an hour and a half, we finally figured out she's paranoid schizophrenic. And, you know, the stories, she couldn't go into a story. It was just vague and around the corners. And it sounded as if she may have been severely abused by a boyfriend at one point. I mean, the stuff about the gun to her head was very plausible. But the other things, I went out with the police outside the city once to a person who was holding down a job. She had a profession of some sort, and she was being every night they're ritually abusing her. Well, what are they doing? How are they getting in? They're getting in the window out there. Well, there's snow on the ground. We went outside. There's no footprints, you know. And then she brought a book out and had underlined words, very clear cases of schizophrenia and so on. So, I was actually involved. I did a ride along with police. And there was a murder in Mill Woods, and the husband tried to cover it up with spraying satanic words on the wall. And, you know, I walked down the stairs, and there was the dead body. And, you know, so it's a complicated issue. I don't know. Given the human depravity, it wouldn't surprise me if people come to believe that there is a God of this world and that God of this world is evil, or sexual deviants want to sanctify their deviance and do quasi-dark religious rituals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talked to a graduate student today. He was at a heavy metal concert in Germany, and they performed Black Mass on stage. So, I mean, it's out there, but it's complicated.
Well, this seems like a good time to bring in a caller with a quick question. Their name is Truth. I don't know if that's a pseudonym or their true name. Are you there, caller? Still working the buttons. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Sorry about that.
Hello.
Hi, and my name is Truth. It's not a pseudo name.
Oh, okay.
Lovely.
My question for Dr. Kent. Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Hello, Truth.
My question for you is, what are you working on now? Or is there a current research project that you're working on that you could share it with us?
I'll share some things. What I was working on this afternoon is another article about fundamentalist Mormon polygamy. It's an issue that, of course, keeps coming up in this country now that there have been two charges laid in British Columbia and Warren Jeff's conviction in the States. Big debate as to whether the polygamy law is going to be upheld as a criminal offense in this country or whether it's going to get thrown out. My prediction is it's going to stand. My prediction is that the polygamy as a criminal offense will remain on the books. There's a lot of debate about it. Beyond that issue, if I ever get this paper finished, I want to go back to some more work on child sexual abuse and alternative religions. There's an extraordinary number of stories about kids being sexually abused in these groups, an extraordinary number, and they go back for a couple hundred years.
Well, isn't it true that there's a lot of child sexual abuse in a lot of mainstream religions as well?
Oh, sure. If you look at the mainstream groups where we would think that accountability structures exist and people are more integrated into society, not afraid of authority figures like police and so on, and yet we still see abuse in these groups, to look at the amount of abuse that goes on in groups that don't have accountability structures that teach their kids that the outside world is scary and dangerous is extraordinary. Some of the most shocking stuff I found is when parents, often mothers, actually will facilitate the sexual abuse of their kids by leaders. There are one or two groups where mothers actually chased down their kids, their daughters, in order to take them to leaders for sexual abuse reasons. It's quite astonishing.
All right. Does that answer your question there, caller?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. I do have a quick question here on Twitter. It's pretty interesting. Apart from time, what differentiates the major world religions from modern cults?
Aside from time, cultural context often matters a great deal. So, for example, the Hare Krishnas, the devotion to Krishna goes back for hundreds, probably well over 1,000 years in India. When it hit North America in the late 60s and early 70s, it certainly had a cult status. Now, however, because of the influx of Indian immigrants, the Hare Krishnas have evolved from what critics used to call a cult into a fairly mainstream immigrant religion. It's also the case, too, that the number of Western converts has diminished. But that's an interesting movement. So there's a whole cultural context there that helps explain how some groups get labeled in one culture one thing and another culture in another way.
Thank you, whoever tweeted that. I actually I think this might be our last question. We're almost out of time. I assume you're familiar with our local College of Integrated Philosophy.
Yes.
It's the followers of John de Ruyter.
Yes. You've
spoken publicly in an article I read about this, but what do you think of that group?
Well, John de Ruyter is a local Edmonton, he calls him, a spiritual teacher to his followers. I believe he portrays himself as the living embodiment of truth. He's attracted a lot of members who had been through previous religious groups like the Rajneeshis. And my sense, when I used to go to John DeRuyter meetings, is that if you were to take a Star Trek tractor beam and beam it down on the hill at the folk festival and suck up those people and send them into a room, they're the John DeRuyter followers. They're
right,
older.
Right.
There's some gray hair. There's some paunches. They've been spiritual questers for a long time. And I'm of that generation. And I must say that for a lot of us, getting older has been a real shock. We expected to live in the dawn, the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And instead, we got Brian Mulroney, Margaret Thatcher, and Ronald Reagan, and then the Bushes and Stephen Harper. So it's been a real shock. The world didn't unfold as we expected. And a lot of that generation was really looking for something spiritual. And John DeRuyter, because he says relatively little, people are able to project into and onto a silence a lot of their own personal needs and meanings and so on.
And that's what I found fascinating, is he will go, you know, up to 40 minutes just staring at a room full of people. And that's his technique. Until you know, there's people crying falling on the ground. And this is, would you consider that a cult?
Well, I call it a group. And I have in the past, not terribly recently, I have in the past gotten phone calls from parents and friends in different parts of U.S. and Canada saying, what's going on? My friend gave up everything and moved to Edmonton. The group, I think, has a sign in the back now saying something to the effect that we don't do psychological counseling, but it's very clear that at least the meetings that I saw, that some people have tremendous emotional needs, and they spill their guts to John, and maybe they get satisfaction from his answers, and maybe they don't. But these are, I think, decent people for the most part, trying to make sense out of their lives.
And on that note, thanks very much, Dr. Kent,
for
being here tonight. And thanks very much to everybody who was on the show this evening. And thanks to Ryan for answering the phones oh so quietly. And to Sean for generally being awesome. And we also have our photographer in the studio tonight, Mark Julian. And Brownian is somewhere. So everyone have a very good night, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
See you then. Painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.